Now, allow me to do a not the big formal intro, but I want to introduce you to Paul and Carol Quist. They're going to speak to us today about the sacrament of marriage, and they're well qualified for this, firstly because they're married. And after for how many years now?
32 years.
And they're well qualified to speak in this particular setting because they too are converts to the Catholic faith. And in fact, they didn't just talk the talk, but they really walked the walk because Paul was a Lutheran pastor. In fact, he was Paul Kathy's Lutheran pastor, meaning that was the family livelihood when he, through, you know, Bible study and the like, had this pulling to the Catholic Church. So in him becoming Catholic, it wasn't just attending classes and all that stuff, it was he had to give up his job and his livelihood for his family in order to become Catholic and then start looking for something else to do to support the family. Four children, yeah?
Three
children. Oh, the fourth one you don't know about. No, I'm just kidding.
Abraham and Sarah.
So they seriously understand the journey that you're on. They have subsequently taken many degrees and whatnot that have put them in a position where they now are employed within the diocese teaching on the subject of marriage. And what's your formal position now?
We're
changed a couple of times.
Yeah, we're directors of marriage and family ministry at Holy Trinity.
Holy Trinity is in Spruce Grove. So they are employed within the church. So please welcome Paul and Carol Quist.
Thank you. We're delighted to be here because we're very enthusiastic about the Catholic faith. It has brought us a great deal of joy. And we believe that you'll find the same if you're on this journey. And actually today, or this year, in 2015, we celebrate our 10th anniversary of being received in the Church, come Easter Vigil. We were received at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Melbourne, Australia, where we sold our house and we moved to Australia to study at John Paul II Institute. And that's where we did our graduate work and came back and have been working in the area of marriage and family ever since. And again, so we're happy to be here because we've found the teaching of the Church on marriage and love and sexuality to be unified, beautiful, and compelling. And we hope that as we begin to open this up with you, that you'll find it compelling too. You want to add something?
Yeah. Sure. Sometimes when we do marriage preparation, on our whiteboard we'll write two titles. We'll put what am I looking for in marriage, and what do I want to avoid? Like, what do I want to look for, and what do I want to avoid? And so people will say, well, what I want in marriage, since they're engaged couples, so they're saying, well, I want love, I want a deep friendship, I want intimacy, I want family, children, and they'll go on, you know, joy and happiness, and then we get to the other side, and they'll often say things like, well, I want to avoid resentment or lack of forgiveness, or avoid divorce, avoid arguing, or they have a whole long list. And usually there's about 20 things on each side, and then we point out, you know, that this, what we want, what we really are looking for is sort of well, in a sense, heaven. Like, we want this intimacy, we want love, we want joy, we want this deep friendship. And the other side starts looking a little bit like hell, right? I mean, all this division and divorce and anger and betrayal and those kinds of things. And marriage really is very linked to eternity. It is our path, for those of us who are married, it's our vocation, it's our calling, and it will lead us to heaven. It is our main way of following Jesus. In the same way that we have a couple seminarians here, their vocation is to another path, and it's also a path, both of them are paths of service. They're both vocations to service. And so I guess just to set that in the context of eternity, that marriage really is equipping us. It's helping us to follow Jesus and purifying us and helping us get ready to to become more like Jesus so that we're ready to meet him. And then also we'll say sometimes, we'll talk a little bit more about this whiteboard that we have in front of them, and we'll say, even if you find yourself at some point in time over on this bad side, like where things are really...
She doesn't mean that board over
there. No. But the whiteboard, where it looks like kind of hellish, and there's all this separation and anger and people are feeling divided and so on. There's still some other H words, not heaven and hell, but there can be hope and there can be healing. And some of the teachings, that we'll be talking about tonight are some of the toughest teachings for people to absorb. They hit us right where we're living. But there's, again, just wanted to start off by saying that there is always a way with God for hope and for healing. And we'll get into that a little bit more as we go on.
Okay. So the sacrament of marriage. That's not our marriage, by the way. Not our wedding. Sometimes when people think of what the church teaches about marriage and sexuality and so forth, all they hear are no, you can't do this, you can't do that. And what we've found is that really the church is a huge yes to love and a huge yes to hope and to faith and to joy. And there's a great deal of confusion in our culture, even in our families, and sometimes, sadly, even in parishes regarding marriage and sexuality. So tonight we'll want to look a little bit at what the church really teaches. And along the way, a question occurs. If we have time, we'll take the questions.
Maybe we'll do most of them after.
Oh, maybe after break we'll do the questions.
Just to clarify, we're done at 8 before the break,
right.
And then we have
8 a.m., isn't that right?
We wish we had more time. It would be awesome to have a whole weekend or something. Because
yeah.
There's so much to unpack. But we'll hit the basics.
Okay.
These topics affect us profoundly because we all bear wounds from mistakes that we've made or abuse that we've endured. We have fears around the whole topic of relationship and sexuality. There's great joy, of course, in married life. It has profound impact on our daily life and on our community. And so again, we just want to say what the church teaches is good news. It's brought us great joy. It's not just a bunch of no's. It's a huge yes to life and love and meaning. And it's linked to our well-being now and in eternity. So our culture. Well, the truth is that we live in a culture that's very narcissistic. You probably recall the story of the Greek myth about Narcissus, who was a very good-looking, influential, wealthy young man, and he was totally enamored of himself. And one day he was looking into a pool of water and he saw his reflection, and he was so smitten that he swooned, he fainted, and he fell into the pond of water and he drowned. And of course, that's the tragedy of narcissism, because we're made for so much more than just self-love. We're made to be a gift to others. But we live in a society that is very narcissistic, and our pop culture encourages that. This is a picture of us.
There we go. It's all about me.
Yeah. And we live in a very hedonistic culture. And of course, hedonism wants to avoid suffering and sacrifice at all costs and pain and to maximize pleasure and comfort. Right. So I think it's just a little picture there. Yeah. And of course, I've never seen that show before.
I think it's old now. I don't know.
I've not seen it.
Oh, okay.
We know something about Alberta Beach Shore.
It's also materialistic.
Yeah, materialistic, meaning two things. Meaning that we get obsessed about owning things and acquiring possessions and wealth. But also, too, we live as materialists a lot in our culture. As though all that mattered was matter. All that is real is what I can see, taste, touch, or define in a laboratory, right? And so the spiritual realities are often overlooked by our culture. So we're, again, we're about wealth and abundance. And also, too, we have a tendency, our culture encourages an immature love that tends towards using each other. We'll talk a little bit more about this later, right?
And the hookup culture.
Yeah, the hookup culture and all that. And it is true that our society can, and our lifestyle can, produce comfort. But as Pope Benedict said, you weren't made for comfort. You were made for greatness. Right? And so we're called to something much more satisfying, much more challenging. So a lot of people end up looking for happiness in all the wrong places. It can become very addictive. Do you want to switch with me and I'll push the buttons and you talk?
Okay. We're back and forth here a little bit. Okay, creation. Adam and Eve. The human person is created in the image and likeness of God. This is really at the very heart of all of the theology on marriage and family life. And we have Adam and Eve, we have the complementarity between men and women. And we now do live in a culture that has even forgotten that basic truth. I was working on a paper a little while ago, and I was really quite surprised to find that Facebook actually now gives 51 different options for gender when you're signing in.
57.
So, no, I think it's 51. It's 58. It's 58. And in the UK, there's 71 choices. So, I mean, we've kind of just lost touch with reality, in a sense. I mean, every cell in each of our bodies is either has an XX or XY, except for a very, very small, very, very tiny amount of people who might, there's a few disorders like with XXY or something. But we've changed from recognizing, not that many years ago, most people would have said, if it's a woman, they say that's a woman. But now you actually can get in trouble, even for identifying someone who wants to be identified as a woman who's a man, you're in trouble. And so, you know, these 71 options are not in touch with biology, for one thing. But there's been even this, there's been a breakdown. I'll just take a little short. Really, when way back in 1968, when Pope Paul VI promulgated a document called Humana Vitae, which means on human life, there was a split happening then, and this document was to say the Catholic Church is still saying that babies and this bonding belong together, that sex is not just about pleasure, it's not just about the beautiful love and deep friendship between two. But it's also about procreation. It's also about babies. And so there's been splits there, and then there's splits even now, you know, between sex and biology. There's a split that way, as we were just talking about. There's a split even between, you know, it's even kind of separating us from reality. Like when you talk about pornography, there's not even a real person there. And certainly not somebody that you're going to meet. And sometimes, you know, there's airbrushing and all those kinds of things. But there's these breaks that have happened in sexuality. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. But there is this complementarity, and that is at the basis, that's at the heart of the teaching on marriage and family. That there, God created us male and female for a really good reason, for many good reasons.
Do you want to say more about that?
You can, if you want to.
Oh, just that, well, as the next line says that male and female have equal dignity and worth, but they're not identical. And isn't that a delightful thing? Mm-hmm. You know, I was just talking to a young guy today. I said, aren't you glad that the world's not just made of men? Wouldn't that be boring if it was all men? I mean, you know, so that there's an essential difference between us. We're both children of God. We both, you know, share that same dignity. However, we look at the world differently. We interact with the world differently. Men tend to be more outgoing and initiating. They're about, you know, the hunting and gathering. And women can tend to be more about I'm falling down. about nurturing. You say.
Well, I guess all I was going to say about that is really the more science finds out about the differences between men and women, the more we see that there's profound differences. Even though we have a culture that's trying to sometimes move towards androgyny and saying we're all the same and there's no difference, science is showing us that even, for instance, there's a whole book called Brain Sex that talks about the different way that we perceive the world. Men and women actually perceive the world in different ways. But just for one example, is that women have a thicker corpus callosum, which connects the two sides of the brain.
I don't have any of that.
and so there's a lot more connections going this way back and forth in women, which allows us to multitask a lot better than men, whose brains are more wired this way, and they're more linear. And there's great gifts in both. There can be, you know, some disadvantages to both too. But the hormones, the way that God created our bodies, it's like there's two different ways of being human, and that's male and female. And really, we are living in a culture that has lost sight of that, which is odd.
Do you want to say anything more?
No.
That's enough enough?
That's enough enough.
So, at the wedding at Cana, you probably recall the story that Jesus and his 12 apostles and his mother were all invited to a wedding in a small village of Cana in Palestine. And in those days, the wedding ceremony often went on for a week, and the whole village was invited. And also in those days, hospitality was really, really important. And at some point during the festivities, Mary, the mother of our Lord, approaches him and says, "They've run out of wine." And that would have been a horrible blunder for the couple. I didn't even know that they were aware of it, but Our Lady, who doesn't miss a trick, notices that they were out of wine. And so she brings this matter to Jesus. And Jesus initially says, "Woman," actually it's a term of respect, he says, "Woman, what has this to do with me, or you and me?" He says, "Because it's not his wedding." And he says, "My hour has not yet come." Kind of a cryptic answer. And so Mary just leaves it with Jesus, and she runs off to the servants who are working at the wedding and says, "Do whatever he tells you." Right? And so Jesus then, at the request of his mother, turns the water into wine. Not just a little water, 180 gallons of water, and it becomes a quality of wine the likes of which nobody's ever seen. Right? So the steward receives this wine. He doesn't know where it's come from. And he goes up to the couple and he says, "Everybody serves the good wine first. And then when people can't tell the difference anymore, they serve the cheap stuff for the rest of the week. But you've saved the best to last." And this miracle of changing water into wine is the first miracle that Jesus performs in his public ministry. And isn't it marvelous that it's at a wedding? It's at a wedding. And he reveals several things. He begins to reveal that he is the bridegroom and the church will be his bride. And this prefigures, too, the great outpouring of his love and mercy that will come on the cross in his shed blood and also in the Eucharist, where all over the world, a vast amount of wine is turned, wine isn't turned back into water, but it turned into Jesus' own blood. Yeah. And so, at this wedding, there's a couple of buttons.
Oh, yeah, there.
So, Jesus begins his public ministry at this wedding, again, at Mary's request. And he begins to fulfill the Old Testament covenants with Israel, some of these things I'm sure you talked about, but then he reveals that there's a new covenant that will be affected by his death and in his resurrection. And so this wedding is a perfect time and place to get across the message that the bridegroom has arrived, and he brings abundant wine, again foreshadowing the Eucharist. Now I was just going to say, he gave that cryptic answer to his mother, "My hour has not yet come." What's he getting at? Well, his hour is when he's going to be revealed. and people will recognize his glory. His glory will be revealed. And that hour will come 3 years later when he faces his passion and the cross and his death and the resurrection. And then what has begun in a very small way here in Cana will reach its fruition on Calvary and in the resurrection.
Okay, so we already mentioned a little bit about vocation, or I did a bit earlier. Priesthood, single, married, religious. All Christians, we're all called to holiness, right? That's our main calling. And which is a personal, profound union with God, getting ready for heaven, dying for God, strengthening ourselves, and learning to serve God and others. There are different ways to do that, and marriage is one of the main ways. All are called to help others grow in holiness. And men are called to marriage. This is their pathway to sanctity and to heaven. What is marriage? We've been talking about it for a while, so let's look at the definition.
So this comes from the Catechism and also from canon law. There's bits of it from both. But basically, the Church teaches, this is what the Church teaches marriage is. And I wish we had a long time to unpack this, but we'll do a little bit of that. Marriage is the intimate, exclusive, indissoluble communion of life and love entered by man and woman at the design of the Creator for the purpose of their own good and the procreation and education of children. This covenant between baptized persons has been raised by Christ the Lord to the dignity of a sacrament. So there's a lot in there. I think what we'll do is just kind of briefly go through it again. So it's intimate. There's no relationship that's more intimate than marriage, right, this side of heaven. It's exclusive. It's one man, one woman. It's indissoluble. That means at that moment, well, marriage happens at the exchange of the consent, and then it's perfected, it's consummated in the marital embrace, in sexual embrace. But it actually, marriage happens at that exchange of consent. And at that point, the couple, who are the ministers of the sacrament, it's not the priest who's enacting this sacrament, it's actually the couple themselves. They are making vows to one another and to God, and everyone, all of their family and loved ones are there hearing this. And God establishes an indissoluble bond at that moment. Okay, so it's indissoluble. It's a communion of life and love. Well, I mean, I guess before I leave indissoluble, I mean, obviously, sometimes there is divorce, and what happens, and sadly, you know, probably all of us know many people who are divorced. So sometimes marriages legally break down, but in God's eyes, a validly established marriage is an indissoluble. Okay, so we'll talk about what an annulment means later. Okay, so intimate, exclusive, indissoluble communion of life and love entered by man and woman at the design of the Creator. So God, who is the author of everything, in his authority, he says that this is the way he established the human person, that we have this beautiful complementarity. And so entered by man and woman at the design of the Creator for, and now there's the two purposes. For the purpose of one, their own good, and also the procreation and education of children. Both of those. And again, there's always all these exceptions. So, you know, obviously some couples can't have children, right? So, love, though, is always needs to be fruitful. So even if a couple can't have children, which is usually a very great sadness to them, there are other ways to be fruitful. We have some dear friends who couldn't have children, and they adopted a couple kids from Korea, and it's a beautiful family. We have other friends who didn't feel that God was calling them to adopt, but they actually, she's the dean, the academic dean at the school we went to in Melbourne, and she's a barrister, and they have many spiritual children. There are different ways that we can be, you know, have that spiritual maternity and paternity, but that we're called, love is needs to have an outlet. Just like a river, you know, a body of water is stagnant and will start dying if there's no outlet. And love, too, needs an outlet, needs to be fruitful. Okay, for the purpose of their own good and the procreation and education of children. This covenant And you've talked about that, I believe, already, right? This covenant between baptized persons has been raised by Christ the Lord to the dignity of a sacrament.
So before, and I just want to clarify,
yes.
If you have got two baptized people, it remains a covenant.
Yes.
But when, like for example, my situation, my
yes.
husband is not baptized, if he were to become baptized, then my marriage would automatically become a sacrament.
Yes.
So that's not to say you have to be baptized in order to have a marriage. You have to be baptized in order to have a sacramental marriage.
Thank you.
Yeah, you have what you call natural
marriage.
Yes.
And
a covenant.
Which was the same kind of marriage that everybody had before Jesus came.
Yes.
Right. And like Darlene said, as soon as the unbaptized member is baptized, then that marriage becomes a sacrament.
And I because what they say
is
elevated.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so that they can become, in a sense, Christ to each other and minister the life of grace to each other.
And one thing that we say, too, when we're doing marriage preparation, because a lot of times there are couples who, these engaged couples, and one of them is Catholic and one isn't. And we say it's not that the church is being exclusive here. It's just that the church would never push itself on, like, would say, oh, well, you have to have this sacrament. It's like baptism is the gateway to all the other sacraments. So the church, God, is never pushy. The church is never pushy. It wouldn't push the sacraments on it. And if anybody wants the sacrament, they know what to do. They get baptized, right? So, but it's, that's why. So it's not to say, no, we're not going to give you one, right? Just to make them, because otherwise sometimes people can feel hurt about that.
So St. Augustine recognized three goods of marriage. The procreation, the fruitfulness is the first good, and you haven't been able to have children. And the faithfulness, the exclusivity, is the second good of marriage. And the third good is the unbreakable bond, the sacramental unity. So those are the three best parts about marriage.
And children are the crowning glory of marriage. And I mean, of course, again, not all couples can have children, but it is such a beautiful... And so the church does say that couples need to be open to the gift of life.
And encourages them to be generous.
Yeah.
To be be in a position where you're trusting God. That's what the church asks.
And it's... Right. And well, we'll get into that later. Sorry, there's so many things to say. Okay.
So many caveats and this and that.
Yeah.
But and so the two purposes... So we have the three goods of marriage. Now the two purposes of marriage. Again, procreation, having and educating children, casting on your faith then. There's a couple doing it. And unity, the companionship, the desire, the gift. And also in that union is the passing on the faith to each other, right?
Yeah.
And stirring each other up to grace and to greater faith. He's telling you something. I don't know what it is. Communion is sacrifice. There's Christ's sacrifice. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So here we have, some of you are probably familiar with this image of the Trinity. It actually comes from that Old Testament story where three angels came and Abraham had hospitality for these three. But it's by Rublev. And so a picture of this unity, what's the phrase again? About the eternal exchange of love between Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And marriage, more than anything else that we can think of, images God. Like it reflects God more clearly than anything else in creation can. And that's because, again, there is, because it's all because God is love, and marriage is the most loving relationship that we can have.
So you think about God, and recall that God is, there's one God, but there's three persons within that God. Three relationships within that one God, is what the church has always taught. And it's hard for us to get our mind around that, but the Father is the originated source of the Trinity. And the Son, the second person of the Most Blessed Trinity, is in a sense the Word. He is the idea of God. It's like if I think about myself, Or if I, you know, there's my thought life, and there's my idea of myself. Well, God is complete, whole, perfect, all-powerful. And so his thought of himself must be like that. And if that's the case, then his thought of himself has all the shares the full nature, or has the full nature of God. And so that's the Son. That's the second person of the Trinity. So the Father, from all eternity, pours all his love, all his divinity into the second person of the Trinity. And the Son receives that gift and gives back himself in all his love.
From
all eternity. And that love between them is so full that that love is embodied in the Holy Spirit, right? The Holy Spirit is the love of God. So that's the three persons, the three relationships. And you can see how the very notion of family arises from that. And that the family is a good image of God, because husband gives himself sacrificially, fully to his wife. And she receives that gift and returns her love, her whole self. And that love between them is so full, so fruitful, that 9 months later you have to give it a name. So we image God in this relationship.
Yeah. Marriage is so very important and so holy and so close to God, who God is. I mean, Satan really is pretty threatened by it and attacks it pretty hard. And we do see a lot of that happening these days. But communion is also very linked to sacrifice, like Paul was talking about, that pouring out of self. And we do, our deepest calling really is to image God, and that means that we too are called to pour out ourselves, just like Jesus poured out himself on the cross. And we're called to pour out ourselves. Like in the Vatican II documents, it says that really we can't truly find ourselves until we learn to make a sincere gift of ourselves. And you know, I think that's why so many people do feel like life is meaningless, because they don't know that. They don't understand that, you know, it's not about getting stuff. You know, getting more money, getting more power, getting more sex, getting more status, getting a better job.
Getting more hair.
It's not about getting. It's about giving. You know, the arrows don't come in, the arrows go out. It's like I become really, truly joyful and truly a fulfilled human person when I recognize my gifts and I share them, when I'm willing to serve, when I'm willing to sacrifice. You know, this is when we feel truly alive. This is when we're most truly human.
And of course, in marriage, we're both, I think we're both doing this. So she's giving herself to me, I'm giving myself to her. So you, as you're giving, you're also receiving. You're receiving from God, you're receiving through the sacraments. So everything's poured into you so that you have the ability to pour yourself out. You don't have to rely on your own strength.
And we do, that's why it's also very linked to the Eucharist. Here we see Jesus on the cross. And of course, in the Eucharist, that is the representation of Jesus on the cross at Calvary. And this is what we're called, and we're not saying that marriage is all about suffering, because it's also great joy, right? But Jesus even said, who endured the cross, for the joy set before him. So joy and suffering are even linked. But this call to sacrifice is a joyful call. And it is at the heart of who we're really meant to be.
You know, in fact, in Croatia, they have a custom where the married couple go together and they pick out a new crucifix that will become a focal point in their home. We have a crucifix over the kitchen sink, so that way I can be doing the dishes and join myself with Jesus while I'm doing the dishes. I'd rather be playing on the computer. And so they buy this crucifix. They bring it to the ceremony, to the wedding ceremony, and the priest, you know, after they exchange vows, invites them to kiss the crucifix. And so it's a very strong message that together they're bearing the cross, they're there for service. And so when they encounter difficulties or joys in their marriage, they focus on Christ. And they take everything to him. and they find the strength that they need to endure and to be fruitful.
And so no surprise that that community where they do that, there's basically next to no divorces. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the way that marriage is to be lived. Love. What is love? Big question of the day. Okay. That's all right. Ti voglio bene. That's Italian for I wish the good for you. And that's, so that sometimes they use that as a greeting, you know.
Well, yeah, that, well, beloved, aren't any people Italian here? Super kind?
Good. Then you won't know if we're lying or not.
but lovers say, ti voglio bene. I love you. That's how we would, but literally, it means I wish the good for you.
And that's a very good definition of love.
It is.
It's not primarily emotion, even though, you know, so much of the media would have us believe that.
And emotion get involved.
Of course. But it's primarily, if you're going to talk about what is it primarily, it's primarily an act of the will. And of course, in marriage, it's I choose you and you alone for the rest of my life. That's an act of the will. And so that even when I'm not feeling like that, when I'm not feeling lovey-dovey, right? I don't feel romantic or anything. I still, I choose you. I've chosen you. I stand by that. It's an act of the will. So it's a very solid, and really at the very essence of who we are, you know, that will, right? We what we choose from the deepest part of us is kind of who we are. So it's an act of the will. Okay. I'm committed to you and your well-being. In John Paul II, he's a philosopher, and he wrote a book.
And a pope.
And a saint.
Yeah, that's right. There we go. Saint John Paul. I know. I so often forget to say saint first. But anyways, he wrote a book that's called Love and Responsibility. And one of his main points in that book was that the more we love someone, the more we feel responsible for that person. And so the people that you feel most responsible for are the people that you love the most. Which is just maybe not a new thought to you, but when I first heard that, I thought, oh yeah. Okay, and so what is love versus lust? Because a lot of people think that the opposite of love is hate. But John Paul II, Saint John Paul II, was really basically said that it's more the opposite is lust. So
because they move in different directions.
Right.
Love is about giving and serving, and lust is about taking or using. Right? And St. John Paul II also said that no one is meant to be used, only loved. Right? God has given us a whole world full of things that we rightfully use, but not people. Okay, lust is directed towards self-gratification.
Love is directed towards self-donation.
Lust treats others as objects.
Love affirms others as subjects.
Lust sees the body as something.
Love respects the body as someone.
Lust, the body is merely biological.
But in love, the body is also theological. It teaches us about God.
Lust sacrifices others for oneself.
But love sacrifices oneself for others.
Lust grasps at fleeting pleasure.
Love yearns for eternal joy.
Lust enslaves us.
Love liberates us.
Lust jealously possesses.
And love confidently trusts.
And lust manipulates and controls.
Love respects people's freedom.
Lust is aimed at any pleasing outlet.
Love is reserved for only one.
Lust rejects suffering.
And love embraces suffering.
And lust sees fertility as a burden, an obstacle.
Whereas love rejoices in the mystery of fertility. We didn't come up with this. This is from Christopher West, who's one of the popularizers of theology of the body. He helped make it more understandable. John Paul's teaching. Theology of the body, yes. St. John Paul's teaching. Okay. Freedom. Now, this is another Christopher West list. And the reason why we're putting it in here is not just because we're Christopher West fans, but because freedom is very, very linked to love and marriage. And actually, oftentimes when a marriage is being examined to see whether it's truly a sacramental, they're looking at freedom. Was there freedom in this consent, in this time when, for instance, there's one where a young man felt very much forced by his soon-to-be mother-in-law to marry the daughter because she was pregnant by him. And he said he really felt forced because he remembers sitting at this wedding, looking across and just saying, I can still get out of this. Now, that's not freedom. That's not a choice. That's not saying I choose you and you alone for the rest of my life. So that's one example of a reason why there wasn't actually a valid marriage ever there in the beginning, which is called the Declaration of Nullity.
We'll unpack some of that probably after the break.
Okay.
But also, freedom is misunderstood in our society. And people confuse freedom and license. So we'll give you the difference between license and freedom.
License. I'll be licensed.
Okay.
License says do what feels good.
Freedom, do what is good.
License, freedom, it's freedom to indulge compulsion.
And it's in freedom, it's freedom from compulsion to indulge.
License is freedom to sin.
Freedom is freedom from sin.
License sees law as the tyrant.
Freedom sees sin as the tyrant.
In license, law feels imposed.
In freedom, law is written on the heart.
License breaks the law.
Freedom fulfills the law.
License says, I'm going to do whatever I want.
And freedom says, do whatever God wants.
License says, any choice is a good choice.
And freedom says, choice is between good and evil. Choose rightly.
Okay, so sacrament. Have you defined a sacrament? Okay, so we don't have to do that. Marriage is one of the seven sacraments. You know the others. We receive grace to live out our marriage. I mean, sacraments bring us grace, right? That invisible help from God that, so we receive that real and true help from God to live out our marriage, the strength to give, to forgive, to love, and to sacrifice. Consent, this is when the marriage happens, at the exchange of the vows, I already said that. And marriage is brought about by that free exchange of consent, properly witnessed by the church. So there needs to be a priest there at the church. So, because there can also be a lack of form. Anyways, there can be...
We'll come back to that.
Okay, yeah. The marriage is not consummated, not sealed and brought to completion until the spouses have sexual intercourse.
In a manner that it's possible to have children.
Okay.
So marriage, kissing doesn't, for instance, that doesn't consummate a wedding, or the vows, just so we're clear on that.
Right. Okay. Marriage does not happen automatically. There can be impediments. There can be things that stand in the way. For instance, I gave one example before, if there's not freedom.
Or for instance, if you don't have the faculties to give your yes, like if you're stoned or drunk, that's an impediment to a vow and wedding. So we always remind people, don't overdo it at the bachelor party. Make sure you're clear and sober.
Right. And actually, the priest, if they smell alcohol in their breath, they are sued.
And it's not enough to show them, and you have to be sober. Okay.
And you also have to be of your right mind. Because that's, again, to me, the deepest part of me, my will, making this very sacred promise.
And so you can't be forced or coerced into marriage either.
Familiaris Consortio, this is one of St. John Paul II's encyclicals. Okay, so we're just closing up here now with just a few quotes, and then we'll be wide open for probably several questions, which is always the most fun part. Okay. In their marriage, a Christian man and woman, placed within the spousal covenant of Christ in the church, love each other with the love of Christ. And their communion of love becomes a sacramental sign of Christ's union with the church. Marriage and marital love are ordered to the procreation and education of children and find their crowning in them, though the communion of life still has meaning and value when it is not possible to have children. These are just a few quotes that we pulled from a very beautiful document. Okay. The family's mission corresponds to its nature. It is called to become ever more a community of life and love. The Eucharist is the source of Christian marriage.
It's the source and summit of the whole Christian faith, the Eucharist, right?
This is just summarizing some of his points. The sacrament of penance, confession, reconciliation, offers grace and opportunity for renewal and forgiveness within the family. It's such an important sacrament. And it really strengthens. We're very blessed. Like, I don't know how we kind of stayed married before being Catholic. I mean, it's so beautiful to have that opportunity to heal ourselves through the sacrament of reconciliation.
To be healed by Christ.
To be healed by Christ, exactly. From the inner circle of the family, love is to be extended to the whole church community and indeed all human beings. So not only is the family the basic building block of society, but it's also the basic building block of the church. And it's not supposed to be just like, okay, you know, my spouse and our children, and we're just all going to be just kind of all loving each other and closing off the rest of the world, kind of hiding away in the hills, like, let's get away from the rest of the world, and just we'll just all be. No, it's meant to both be the subject of evangelization, or the object of evangelization and the subject. Basically, sometimes families need to be evangelized, but families are also to be evangelizing, going out and sharing the good news of Jesus with the world.
And often just by their presence.
Well, that's right.
Yes. And that's, yes, thank you.
When Christ is in the home, people come there and they see love and laughter, forgiveness, hope, joy, and that's very attractive. And so the home, the family, becomes an oasis and a very arid landscape. People are dying to find that kind of happiness, that kind of peace. And so when they experience it in your home, it draws them to not only you, but to Christ and His church.
Life-giving love. Babies are the best. Okay, the church reaffirms her teaching on the transmission of life, particularly that marital love must be open to new life. The union of the conjugal act, loving, self-giving, and procreation is founded in an integral vision of the human person in God's plan. God's plan for the transmission of life in the family is included in their call to holiness. So we're not just saying this is just a little set kids over here. Now this is integral. This is like a very part. This is how we grow in holiness too, is by having children and by sharing and learning to give to them and learning to teach and forgive and to learn from our kids sometimes.
Yeah, we learn to fix all the things they break.
Okay, and we will. She'll probably have some questions on this. I hope we have some questions on this because I think this might be our last slide. Or it's getting close. The moral difference between natural family planning and the pill. First of all, maybe not all of you have heard what natural family planning is. Probably most of you have. But in case you haven't, okay, there are me pulling up a sheet, so you've got a sheet in front of you. But it's a means, it's a method. Well, actually, there's more than one method, but they're all basically keeping track of women's fertility, because women are fertile for a small part of each month. Men are fertile all the time. And so, but women are fertile for a small period of time, and so it's basically avoiding, you can use natural family planning either to achieve a pregnancy or to postpone a pregnancy. And
so if a couple has a valid, you know, good, serious reason to postpone having a child, this is a legitimate way to do so.
Yeah, and we can get into that more after break. Okay. So I'll be natural family planning, you can be the pill.
Okay,
here we go.
I am a pill.
Okay, so in natural family planning, no action is taken against the child, nor against co-creating with God. Every marital act is open to a child and to God.
So the pill involves an action against the child and against co-creating with God, thereby diminishing the welcome to child and to God.
In natural family planning, there is no possibility of abortion. Sorry.
With the pill, there is a possibility of abortion.
And we can tell you more about that later if you're wondering about that. There is in natural family planning, there's no possibility of harm to the woman's body. It's just going along with the woman's body.
Using any hormonal contraception, there is a possibility of harm to the woman's body.
And then most of the different methods besides the pill too. Natural family planning strengthens those three goods of marriage.
And the pill weakens the three goods of marriage.
Back to those, what are they? Procreation, faithfulness, and the bond, the indissoluble bond. Natural family planning does not split the procreative, having babies, from the unitive, that love and bonding.
And the pill splits the procreative from the unitive.
Natural family planning builds on solid understanding of who a human person is,
while the pill diminishes one's understanding of who a person is. I mean, these, you know, we just kind of laid them out.
We have another quiz for Leslie. Yeah, and so we can talk more about that after. Okay, I think this is our last one. I think so. Okay, so our last slide. If we're ever to discover true love, true joy, true happiness, we must discover the nuptial, the marital meaning of the body and live according to it. Live according to it. That's from John Paul II.
And that's not only for the married. Like priests and religious are called to the nuptial meaning of the body. They, however, make that sincere gift of self in a different way. The priest gives himself to his bride, the church, right? And the nun or the religious sister gives herself to her groom, Christ. And husband and wife give themselves to each other and through each other through that marital bond to God.
And so it's all, whether, you know, whichever vocation you have, it is a pointing to the eternal. It's a pointing to God. It's an imaging of God to the world. And so, again, it's like, if we really want love, if we really want joy and happiness, we want to understand that complementarity, that pouring of self, that sacrifice is very linked to joy and to who we are as human persons.
And just one final sentence. And the reason that it raises joy in us is because we are created in the image and likeness of God. And God is all about self-care. It's clear in the communion of love in the Trinity. It's also clear in the fact that God created us for no other purpose than to share his love with us, his dignity with us. And also, too, it's clear in...
Thank you.